You please join me in prayer. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, Blessed Master, saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only King, reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Welcome this morning. Looks like we have several playing hooky today. We have a new journal out, so encourage you to take one, and they'll be mailed out soon. Reading from a talk that's transcribed from others. The Eternal Universal Christ Consciousness. Mother speaking, Master wrote something about Christ consciousness, which is absolutely eternal, and further than that, it is universal, because it refers to the Christ consciousness present in every man and in every atom of space. The metaphysical way to Christ consciousness is graded. That way is through meditation and holding on to the after effects of meditation. Your present consciousness is limited by the body, but when you expand it by deep meditation, you will become aware of the feelings of all people. You will be able to know all things. Marvelous revelations will come to you. Sometimes when that state comes, you feel yourself simultaneously in the stars, in the moon, and in every blade of grass. Christ consciousness is the divine consciousness present in all of creation. We are a part of that Christ consciousness. Each individual intelligence is a part of that Christ intelligence, and beyond creation is cosmic consciousness. We are like the jets in a burner of a gas stove. There are many little holes through which the gas flames are pouring, but under the burner there is only one flame. We are little flames coming from the big flame of life. Beneath all the tiny jets of human life is one life. Behind the flowers, behind all nature, is one life. When you feel your consciousness in every pore of creation, you have Christ consciousness. And when you lift your consciousness from creation and see the vast eternal joy of God alone, you will be in cosmic consciousness. When you are in tune with that cosmic consciousness, which is beyond this creation, you will understand that God begat his intelligence in the womb of creation, the Virgin Mary, and that this intelligence of God, the Father, which is reflected or born in every atom of creation, is the Christ consciousness or the only begotten Son. Mother speaking. Now, that's quite different than what we have been taught and raised with as Christians. But I learned more about Christianity from my Hindu guru than I have ever learned in all the years of going to an Orthodox church, because he taught me that God was within me, that the words that Jesus spoke were absolutely the truth, and they applied to me as well as to him, that they applied to every man, woman, and child in this whole universe. That God was within me. It was this temple that held the living God, and that he was my life, my intelligence, my strength, my supply, my love, my everything. And he took away the fear of hell and purgatory and damnation that had so greatly placed in my mind as a child. And all of a sudden I was lifted up, and I felt all warm and taken care of and comfortable. It was as though I'd been wrapped in a warm blanket of spirit. I felt God's love permeate my being. I felt it all around me. And I put my mind not on sin, not on hell, not on damnation, but upon the eternal God through that consciousness which is in the Jesus, the Christ Jesus. What a change it makes when we begin to really understand that these Christian scriptures are not written as a historical note, but rather that they are the story of every man going from the human to the divine. Last evening we saw a movie, I believe it was made for television, about Solomon. And it was well done in many ways, but it seemed to lack any real spiritual power. It was really about more as him, the human being, Solomon, the human being. But it had many good aspects to it. I was going to read from the Metaphysical Bible Dictionary, Charles Fillmore. This is really a truly inspired work where Charles Fillmore, through his own inner revelations, is able to perceive some of the deeper nature of these biblical stories and the names that are within the stories, because the names are encoded aspects of what we all experience within us. The cities, the people, the actions, one army against another, all of these things are descriptions of what goes on inside of us, within our own consciousness. The different wars that are described are the wars that we feel within ourselves. Isn't it true that so oftentimes, particularly if we decide to do something or strive for something great, we find immediately that we are placed upon a battleground. A part of us wants to do this new thing, achieve this new goal, and a part of us resists it with everything that it has. And back and forth goes the battle. And this is the way that it is as it's described within the Bible. You can say that Adam and Eve are symbolically our consciousness when it first comes into material consciousness. And it describes within Genesis how man became separate from God. Before that, there is an automatic attunement. There was no separation. There is an ongoing communion, a conversation going on between the lower aspects of consciousness and the higher aspects. But when the division came, then came all the trouble, isn't it? Then you had Cain and Abel, and one was killing the other out of jealousy. And down goes the devolution into human consciousness that is devoid of divine consciousness. Divine consciousness is not just a philosophy. It's not something either just to believe in, to have faith in, but rather it is a living reality. However, because we have followed this story of Adam and Eve, we are not just the recipients of what two souls did many thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years ago. Rather, it is a description of what we have gone through. And in the great divorce from the divine consciousness, we have come to see ourselves as autonomous, independent, and unconnected beings. We see other people as completely separate from us. We don't see this universal vision that Master is describing, where we feel ourselves to be a part of the earth, a part of other human beings, through this divine communion that we get through this Christ consciousness. This Christ consciousness is eternal, and this Christ consciousness is universal. It is not contained to just one human being who lived 2,000 years ago. But in the story of Jesus, we see there the complete redemption that the consciousness goes through when it is ready to ascend to that highest level. In the story of David, and in the story of Solomon, both are predecessors to that Christ consciousness coming. And they both are symbolically what happens as we begin to rise above the purely individualistic nature. That individualistic nature, we know through the consciousness within the spine that it is relegated to the three lower centers within the spine, at the base of the spine, then somewhat above the spine, and then just behind the navel. And symbolically, this represents the earth consciousness, then the sensual, the sexual nature of consciousness, and then the will nature of consciousness. Finally, when we are ready to step into that next evolutionary movement, we go to the heart center. And in a human sense, we get that heart center opened when we fall in love with someone. Suddenly, or we are willing to do something for another person that isn't just strictly what's in it for me. I really want, when we enter into the heart center and not just lust, I really want what is best for another person, beyond my own needs, beyond my own wants. And this is the first expansion into divine consciousness. But David represents a movement more solid into divine consciousness of the heart. He aspires to love God, to know God, to know God's will. His mind is very, very fixed upon God's will. But even from the very beginning, he is a warrior. He is asked to go out and he is to do battle with Goliath. And he takes five smooth pebbles, representing the five lower chakras. And he, with his will, flings one of those stones and hits Goliath in the forehead. And the forehead represents the ajna. This describes the experience when the heart opens up and you are able to see into the ajna, or the sixth center, for the first time. You transcend the beast or the giant of the ego. And you transcend it. You go beyond it. And it represents a victory. But David is still very much of mixed nature. He goes back and forth. And all of his life, even till the very end, he is constantly at war. And he wants to build the temple of Jerusalem. The temple is the heart center. It is to become solid. Before that, the temple is a tent. And it moves around because they are a nomadic people. The tent moves around with the people. But suddenly, there is an establishment of that tent. And David cannot do it because he is of the warrior. He has aligned himself with the third chakra. And so he cannot transcend. That is the chakra of will. And it is a necessary thing for him to do to establish a kingdom. But he can't bring to fruition the temple as a permanent establishment within the heart center. So it is left to Solomon. And I'm reading here from the Metaphysical Bible Dictionary that Solomon is a Hebrew word, and it means whole, entire, complete, integral, peace, concord, integrity, rectitude, soundness, peaceful, pacific. And he goes on, a son of David by Bathsheba, and king of Israel after David. Metaphysically, Solomon represents the state of mind that is established in consciousness when the soul is unified with wisdom and love. Solomon stands for more than a great Hebrew king and a wise man, is quite evident to those who have searched deeply in religious and mythological history. As students who look especially for the information about the individual man, we discern in Solomon a development of the presiding genius at the heart center. In Scripture, brain and nerve centers, or more strictly speaking, thought centers, are designated as cities, and the presiding or ruling intelligence that controls or directs the work of any center as a personality. Jerusalem, city of peace, stands for the heart center, and Solomon, the peaceful man, stands for the presiding intelligence. When the ruling intelligence is in harmony with the fundamental character of the center, rigid construction of the spiritual body goes on. We are told that David could not build the great temple because he was a man of war. When violent and resistant emotions hold sway in the mind, the turmoil is such as to prevent any permanent construction of the new body on the higher planes of consciousness. So we see the importance of cultivating peace instead of war, non-resistance instead of resistance, harmony and love instead of discord and hate. Solomon was also a great judge. When asked by the Lord what he should give him, Solomon chose wisdom above riches and honor. Then all the other things were added. Solomon was given a rare intuition, and he used it freely in arriving at his judgments. He did not rest his investigations on the visible facts, but he sought out the inner motives. In the case of the two women who claimed the same infant, he commanded an attendant to bring a sword and cut the child in two and give a half to each woman. Of course, the real mother begged him not to do this, and he knew at once that she was the mother. The symbolic objective of Solomon's assembly, assembling the head men of Israel, is to construct under the guiding light of divine wisdom an imperishable body. All constructive processes must be under the guidance of divine wisdom. The elders, the heads of the tribes, and the princes represent the directive powers to which the various aggregations of thought and subconscious look for instruction. Now, this is very important in the development of the God-man. It is not the final step, of course. As we know, that came with Jesus. But Solomon represents the next stage of evolution after David. David aligned with the third chakra, with will. And Solomon, when he is asked by God, even as a young man, what gift he would like to have. Now, this could include anything at all that he might like to have, but spontaneously what came out of him was that he wanted wisdom. He wanted discernment. And through that prayer, the heart center is then united with the fifth center, which has to do with discrimination, with the knowledge of Dharma. And because of this, he transcends his father, and he takes evolution to the next stage. Through the next 7 years, he is in the construction of the temple. Now, the temple is now moved from the tent into this grand building that is built with many symbols of God's power on earth. And God is said to then to have inhabited that temple. And this happens when we really set our feet solidly upon the spiritual path, when we really exercise discernment in our life. We move past some of the warring states of earlier spiritual practice where it is always just a constant back and forth. We're always striving, it seems like, but very little attainment. Every once in a while, we get an inspiration, we get an upliftment in consciousness. But now as we purify the heart center even more, Solomon emerges. And through that Solomon consciousness, there is a knowledge, there is a wisdom that begins to come to us. It is not just simply the laws of Moses that are on the tablets. This is something that is done in stone. It's something that is more for the material mind. And it is something that the material mind can grasp, but it is of a lower nature still. Now Solomon is attuned to intuition, and through that intuition, he automatically knows what the higher path is, what the higher nature is. This is a tremendous movement in consciousness. Now we sink deeper into a sense of peace, and it's from that peace that Solomon represents, that wholeness, that sense of completeness comes to us. The battles begin to die down, and we feel more established. We feel that we are more focused on the divine consciousness, that we have access to divine realms. God begins to dwell within the temple. that presence begins to dwell as a living reality. No longer is it something that's theoretical or vague or philosophical and something of the mind. Now it is a living reality within your own inner temple, this temple not built with hands, this body temple. And through that, instructions come. And there is a solidification within your own spiritual consciousness. You feel solid with God. You feel that God is a living presence. But over time, things begin to go wrong for Solomon. He gathers all the tribes together. He appoints elders. There is a sense of consciousness where you're all coming together as a spiritual being. And this happens when you first go through these Kundalini spiritual experiences. And suddenly your whole journey begins to take on a kind of solidity that it never had before. But there are also temptations that come along. And one of the temptations that comes for Solomon is the Queen of Sheba. She comes up from Egypt, and Egypt symbolically represents the darkness. It's the lower centers. It is the center of lust, of the second center. And it so oftentimes happens that when people enter into spiritual experiences, somebody meets someone, you meet somebody who you feel is your soulmate for the first time. There are many indications that this may not be really a very spiritual person. It is something of purely the human passion. But you feel like this person completes you. You feel like this person is the one that you have been waiting for all of your life. And this is because as you are ascending up into the higher realms of consciousness, you are meeting soul, you are meeting the divine consciousness within yourself. Suddenly, your second chakra gets activated. And from this second chakra, it gets imbued with this spiritual light and luster. You feel like this is the one. And it is coming in a human form. And now you are in grave danger in a terms of spiritual evolution. Whether you choose to continue to ascend upwards or whether you're drawn down into the lower centers. And a great battle ensues. And back and forth you go. It is terrifically powerful, this pull taking you down into the lower centers. And it seems as if the allure of divine consciousness, which seems so alive for you before, so solid inside of you, so filled with peace, now there is no peace in the kingdom. Now there is no feeling of solidity towards divine consciousness. You are pulled with this terrific force to go downwards. And this is what Solomon does. He gradually makes those decisions that this queen that he has fallen so deeply for is pulling his consciousness down. He gets his advisors and they advise him. They tell him he is going in the wrong direction, but he doesn't want to hear it. There's a kind of arrogance now that takes over. And through that feeling of pull, you feel like you can do without God, that everything is dependent upon this outer relationship. And the reason you feel so powerfully that way is because this divine luster that you are feeling within your consciousness is now surrounding, like a halo, this individual that you are meeting. And you feel like that individual is God itself. So you have placed this object, this person, and you have put it up on the altar, and you are now worshiping it as if it were God, because it has taken on that allure and that luster that God once had for you. And if you go with that, then the consciousness is brought down, down into the lower centers, down into Egypt. You don't care. You're just willing to go with it, no matter where it takes you to. And down you go. And now all the 12 tribes are torn asunder. You no longer have that peace. You no longer have that harmony. You no longer have that divine consciousness. Now, all is not lost, because eventually you can climb back up to that same place of decision-making. You can still come back into that consciousness of Solomon. But it may take a very, very long time for that to happen, because you get very lost in that separation. And you get very stubborn about what you want. And then if your pride takes over, you don't want to admit that you've gone down the wrong road. You don't get back onto track. And so you justify it. And you find all kinds of reasons why you want to continue in the way that you have. And as individual souls, we have that freedom. It is not that there is an outside force in consciousness that is dictating to us what we should do and what we should not do. And if we don't do it, then there is some sense of revenge or anger upon us. This is an old way of speaking about things. But it is rather like the forces of nature, the forces of gravity, for instance. And if you go against the law of gravity, you will pay a price. If you're standing up on a 10-foot ledge and you jump off, you're going to land with a great force, with all the force that gravity takes over with. Now, you would not say that gravity is taking revenge on you for not doing what it wants you to do. You would just say that's the force of gravity. And even so, there is spiritual law. It is just simply how things work. And if we go against the spiritual laws within ourselves, then we pay a price. Now, it spoke here, Master did, of this tremendous upliftment that we go through, and we begin to perceive that the divine consciousness is in everything. We lose the sense of I and mine. But if this is done prematurely, this is what we call mental illness. And suddenly there is a psychic tear that happens within the consciousness. And there is a stream of thinking that comes up from the subconscious mind that ordinarily is retained in our dream states. There's also a tear within the psychic body that allows the thoughts, the feelings, the impressions of those who are around us to come streaming into the consciousness. Normally, we are oblivious to these kind of things, or we rarely get those kinds of thought impressions. But now, because this has happened prematurely, and because oftentimes we have delved into what sometimes are called the dark arts, those things that are of a more psychic phenomena, and we open ourselves to it, we want to do this. This is part of what Solomon does. He begins to worship these lower images once he has resigned himself from the light, once he has chosen to turn away from it, and he looks for powers. He gets obsessed with this looking for powers. And he tries to do it by worshiping these lower images, these lower gods, so to speak. And as a result of that, he becomes very, very lost. And this happens within the consciousness. It happens to many people. And they may go through a period of insanity once they lose connection with reality. Now their reality is this stream of thoughts and feeling impressions that come up from the subconscious mind without the usual protection we have with that. Or it comes from all these thought impressions from other people and other places and other things that come streaming in through our psychic nature. And now we are in real trouble because we can't discern the difference between what is streaming to us from the unconscious mind and from the psychic phenomenon, and what is what we might say is real, or how we ordinarily perceive this reality. So through this psychic tear, we enter into what is nowadays called mental illness or psychosis. And as I say, we are in real trouble now. Now it takes a long time to begin to heal that psychic tear, to begin to form the integrity of consciousness once again. And as we do so, we begin to work our way back up the ladder of evolution once again, until we come back to that same point that Solomon faced. And sure enough, as we enter into that deeper spiritual nature, temptation once again rears its ugly head. Some other object, some other person becomes imbued with all those wonderful spiritual qualities. Now, part of us knows that this isn't true, that this individual cannot contain all of the spiritual qualities that we are ascribing to them. And so we turn away from it. And it takes a great effort of will and takes a great attunement to the intuitive wisdom. You see, Solomon, when he originally turned away from it, he knew he was turning away from it. He didn't care. He wanted what he wanted. And this is the nature of the ego. It wants what it wants. And it doesn't care what the consequences are. But when you're attuning yourself to truth and to higher consciousness, you think beyond that. You get grounded in that higher wisdom. And as you do so, you continue on. And this is the description of Jesus and what he goes through out in the desert. He's tempted. He is tempted with powers. He is tempted with all the things, even as the Buddha was tempted on his night of transformation. And the night represents the darkness of consciousness. It's when you don't have the full illumination in your mind and these tempting forces come to you. And all these temptations come to you, but you resist them. You know that they don't take you to anywhere good. You know through your own experience that if you go with these lower forces, all the promises that they make, the promises of comfort, the promises even of enlightenment, the promises that they are surely whispering into your ears, they will not come to fruition. You recognize them as a liar and a thief, as Jesus said, from the very beginning. They lie to you because they promise you that you will have all this happiness from these things of the world. And it's a thief because it robs you of your peace, of your joy, of the inner light, if you choose to go with them. And so you turn away from them. You keep your mind focused upon God. And when you do so, you enter in to the higher nature of divine consciousness. But this is not the end, and this is what we are marking, the anniversary of Easter, is the marking of when the consciousness is moving through its final temptations. It comes into Jerusalem, or the heart center that is resplendent with divine consciousness. It is radiant with that divine consciousness. You hear the sound of God's name being uttered everywhere. And even if the people were to stop, the stones themselves would sing out with that divine vibration because it is evident everywhere, all around you. And it seems as though you are to be crowned king of this world, of divine consciousness. And yet there is one more thing to be gone through. And this is this great final great temptation that happens in the Garden of Gethsemane. This is what we are focused on at this time of year. It is a wonderful time of year because symbolically it is the time for spring. It is the time of renewal. It is a time when we come out of the dead and into the living, coming from winter into spring. So it is an appropriate time that the resurrection should happen at this time. But first, symbolically, there needs to be this tremendous death experience. Now, this is not death of the body, even though it is portrayed as such. What it is death of body consciousness, the limitations of body consciousness. It is the death of ego consciousness that is very much tied to this body. But here we are getting ahead of our story somewhat, because now we are recovering, or we are moving through that Solomon consciousness. It is a forerunner of that Christ consciousness. But we must learn the lessons well of what Solomon was faced with, and what he overcame in his ascension from the human to the divine. This is a very real temptation that comes, and it is the doom of the temple, and it is the doom of the 12 tribes that represent the 6 lower chakras by polarity. Each one has a positive and a negative charge associated with each one. And when you collect all these 12 tribes, you are now completely and wide open in perfect balance with all the six chakras. And now they are functioning as they were designed to function. And as St. Paul said, as before, I saw as through a glass darkly. When I closed these two eyes, I did not see the divine light. I did not feel the divine wisdom within me. But later, I see clearly. And now divine consciousness is awakening within you. You see the divine light with your inner eye. You hear the divine voice through the Om and through the music of the spheres. These are not hallucinations. These are not signs of psychosis. Psychosis is the opposite. It's when the ego cannot contain this disillusion that occurs between the individual and the universal. But when the ego is ready, it has to be a strong ego in that sense, because it has to be strong in order to perfectly surrender itself. It's not a tear now, it's a dissolution of the ego consciousness into divine consciousness. This is a wonderful, wonderful time for the soul. Now it is entering into the final birth process, but before the birth comes the death. Even as the fetus enters through the mother and comes out into the world, you can say it's a death to womb consciousness, and now is a birth into world consciousness. It has to leave one in order to enter the other. And you leave the human consciousness, and you enter into divine consciousness. And this makes all the difference, all the difference. As I say, let us learn this lesson well, because we will be faced with temptations as we move through these different stages of consciousness. And unless we have an awareness and an absolute determination of will to achieve the highest states of divine consciousness, then we will be swept back into the lower stages, and we will not be happy there. We will not be happy, even with all the promises of happiness that comes with it. These are wonderful, instructive stories. And if we would really see ourselves as moving into these states, then a tremendous transformation will come forward. And I would like to read here from this wonderful little book on A Goddess Among Us about the life of Anande Moy Ma. And it's speaking here of some of Ma's wonderful experiences as she goes through these different stages. And here in Ashtagram, Ma first manifested unearthly bhavas, or plays, leelas, during a kirtan organized by some neighbors. As the men sang to the accompaniment of the drums and hand cymbals, the women watched from separate quarters at some distance. Suddenly Ma's body was drawn up like a dry leaf in the wind, and barely touching the ground, she floated in the midst of the kirtan gathering, exhibiting all the signs of a mahabhav, or a divine absorption, a highly charged spiritual emotion arising from an intense love for God. Ma's body was alternately floating and rolling on the ground to the rhythm of the music, her eyes and face bathed in a radiant glow. Finally, she sank to the ground and entered into a deep trance. As she remained in this state for a long time, the kirtan had to be resumed to bring her back to normal consciousness. In 1918, Ramani was posted as an estate clerk of Bijapur, near Dhaka. It was now that the most intense and esoteric stage of Ma's life began, and perhaps this phase of her life is of the deepest significance for all sadhakas. Ma frequently used the word Kyle to describe the inspiration for her actions. The word loosely implies a mood or frame of mind. Ma used it to denote an inner movement of divine will, which then took expression in thought or speech. Since Ma was pure consciousness and had no mind in the form of conscious or subconscious conditioning, divine inspiration and desire alone expressed itself through what we call thought in her mind. It was this alone that motivated her speech and movements. Ma describes the beginning of this next phase of her life in this way. One morning, as she was bathing in the pool at Bajetpur, she felt a chile arising in her mind. What would it be like to play the part of a sadhaka, or a spiritual aspirant? Before, you see, she was born into this complete and pure consciousness, she had no sense of separation. With that inner movement of thought, Ma described that the integral and perfect knowledge of reality, which had been with her since birth, had a slight veil drawn over it, simply to see how it would be pierced. Hence, the Leela of sadhana began and continued with intensity for the next 6 years. As in every phase of Ma's life, she herself did nothing willfully, but everything manifested spontaneously and effortlessly. Every evening, after completing her household duties, Ma took her husband's permission to practice spiritual disciplines. She would clean a section of the room where she slept, and after lighting incense, would sit silently in yoga asana. Then, quietly repeating Hari, the name of God, she would enter into a deep state of meditation. Every night, her husband would curiously observe her until sleep overtook him. He observed how various yogic asanas and kriyas would spontaneously and gracefully manifest in her. At one point, he asked her, "We are Shaktas, so why are you saying the name of Hari?" Hari is to do with Krishna, and Shakta has to do with Shiva. Ma replied, Why should I say Jai Shiva Shankara? He agreed, and Ma continued with this name. The yogic manifestations continued to unfold whenever she was repeating that name, illustrating the point that all divine names are equally potent. Here is a tremendous soul who had all the centers open, even from birth. It's a rare thing. As Mother described, an avatar, one who was born perfect in consciousness and came into earth consciousness this way. But she wanted, through divine will inside of her, to experience what it was like to practice spiritual discipline, to have a veil between the individual and the universal. And in this way, she could be an example for us all, and she could also know what it is like to go through those various spiritual stages. These great souls all share one thing, and that is their complete and total love for God. They want that divine consciousness more than anything else in this world. They've come to that point where they realize that this world does not hold anything of any absolute value. There are relative values, there are relative goods, and that there is nothing wrong with these things. But when it comes to this state of mind, then we put our entire attention upon the divine consciousness alone. Love for God means a desire for God, a desire that transcends all other desires. Now we want God more than anything else. We're able to face those temptations that came to Solomon, and we're able to transcend them and to continue upon our spiritual path and to progress to even higher stages. This is a wonderful opportunity we have been born with, and if we take full advantage of it, then we can learn through our own experience what it is like to enter into those highest stages of divine consciousness, become established in them, and become completely transformed in our nature from the human to the divine. Please pray with me.
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence
in every part of my being.
In every part of
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at thy
feet. And surrender myself to thee.
And surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Amen. I bow to the light.